designs, everything is lighter, smaller, less expensive, more efficient. So I'm a big fan of the 21st century. Ed, you wanted to say something? Unfortunately, you guys kind of doubled with Wesley as well.
Yes, I do, Walter.
Feel free, Ed.
In the Army, we didn't have all these convenient machines. We welded off the 24 volts, which are two 12-volt batteries in series on the trucks, and that was our welder over.
Ah, that's a good one. Does it really give you a good welding job, or is it quick and dirty and better than not?
It was excellent. That means, but you had to know how to weld well using stick. A stick is like a rod with a flux on it. I know it's very early and it's very archaic, but it worked. Over.
Ah, very good. That's a great story. I know very little about welding, unfortunately. It just it never came up any place that I can imagine. I never felt the need to weld. I know we have a few people out there listening tonight who play around with it, who have a couple of welding tools. They do it as a little bit of a hobby and such, but I don't know. I don't know where I put a welder like that. I don't have that much room for much of anything these days.
PhD.
Yes, Jim.
Thank you, Roy. This is Jim, KD2VHD. I have to compliment Wesley for his shot at Garage Tech. There's no Mio Maisons involved, and I appreciate your effort, Wesley. There is a whole cottage industry in improvised welders, you know, in the have-nots of Appalachia and the third world countries. Well-known of taking microwave ovens out of the garbage and making electric welders out of them for various specialty uses and whatnot. And the pure DC off the 24 volts of the military vehicles, I imagine, was a nice clean weld as long as you didn't use the stick to the workpiece and blow off the batteries. But I think there's something to value what you're talking about, Wesley. My two sons are trained welders. I have welders all over my garage. I don't know how to use any of them. I don't have a clue. So, thanks for bringing up the topic. It's a tough one to digest, but I have to give you credit. Hold on. Thanks, Roy.
Okay, very good, Jim. Nice to hear amiable discussion for a change. No one yelling at each other. It's just kind of, just kind of saying one word or two words and just wandering back into the ether. Anyway, anything else on this particular subject, Wesley?
I have some more information. So at first there was AC welding, but it had certain problems, and then people found how to rectify the current and found that DC welding is much better than that. And there was tremendous diets later on, but before that, they were using selenium rectifiers. Some old guys remember the selenium rectifiers. When they got burned, they were smelling very ugly. Dr. Roy, do you remember what I'm talking about?
Well, it's not that I remember, because I don't think I owned anything with a selenium rectifier. I certainly read a great deal on selenium rectifiers. I've seen some pictures of them. I have at least one image kind of burnt into my brain. And I heard the stories that when they burn out, they stink like heck.
Rotten eggs.
I would assume that would be the hydrogen sulfide. I don't know, but maybe it's just the oxide of selenium.
Okay. So, yes, rotten eggs. So then they start to use diet, a humongous diet with the heat sink. And it was, it started like a beginning of 70s and 80s, 90s and so on. And then there was a kind of branching. We don't have a welder, we have a welder for a specific job. So they had the TIGs. They had the welders for the thin metal with the wire, welding wire moving on the coil with the motor on it, and it has shielding gas. So at the high temperatures, the oxidants and other gases in the atmosphere tend to react with the metal in the weld pool and cause imperfections that damage the quality of the metal joints. That's why they use that. Now, would you believe they were using helium? They were using helium for welding. Of course, it was beautiful, but helium, yeah, argon is being used still, but helium is in deficit. They also use carbon dioxide for the type of welding that the electrodes may be coated with flux and a material that releases the shielding gas while it melts, or shielding gas that may be pumped through the welding tool out of the special holding stand. Back to you.
Are you talking about a MIG welder again?
Actually, yes, MIG welder, right. So, that was the beginning of it. I was welding a lot when I was young, and never had to do it from the work. It was, I was curious. I had all kind of welding machines, the spot welder also for welding two pieces of metal together, or two pieces of sheet metal. Yeah, that was actually a great experience. The reason that I started the discussion was it's supposed to be a puzzle, but I'm not good in puzzles, so yep. How can you regulate the current? So, the first, they were moving coils, the primary and the secondary, so one of the coils was with the screw, the humongous screw and the wheel, and you were able to move that coil away from the primary one. Now then when the new time, new modern time came in, they decided that they can do it with electronics. So instead of having a steady current, whatever the current it is, it could be 400 amps, but it could be 4 amps regulated, they decided that they can have the electronics that gives you the impulse. So now the proper shape of the impulse is doing the job. And because it is not welding all the time, like the traditional one, it is giving you the impulses, and between the impulses there is nothing in it, because that part of the metal is still hard and area around it is ionized. It actually gives you perfect welding. Back to you, Dr. Ross.
That'll be right to end.
Yes, Paul.
I think Wesley was get a kick out of what I'm going to tell him. I'm going a little off this topic, though. If you take a regular DC well, you know, reverse polarity, and you know you have the work that you're welding, and then you have the welding rod, in your stinger. Like, you know, that stinger is like a big alligator clip, you know, and that's what you're welding with. So what do you think would happen if you take 100 watt incandescent light bulb, not an LED, 100 watt light bulb, and take the positive end of that light bulb and put it on the work, and then take the stick, you know, you were going to weld with. Just touch the side of that light bulb. Do you think the light bulb will not light? Do you think it will blow up in your hand? What do you think would happen? And anyway, back to you.
Okay, Wes, you got an answer?
Because the circuit with the welding rod, so the light bulb has a current on it. At first, it will have a spark before it sticks. So, the welding rod has a tendency to stick and stick. So, it's no spark, it's no gap, it sticks. It usually happens in 18. But if you have a DC, you may actually have a welding on the light bulb. But the light bulb will give you the light. Enter XCS.
Very good. Anyway, we used to do it all the time. It was amazing. You take the 100 watt light bulb and do what I just said, and you touch the side of that light bulb, and the light bulb would light up. No problem. You know, any new guys coming in, you know, hey, look at this. I'm going to touch the side of the light bulb. What are you, nuts? You know, and, you know. And it would light up. In fact, if you guys were in a dark situation, you didn't have a flashlight handy, or and you wanted to see something, just take a light bulb that's laying around, put it on the end, and it lights up. It's weird. It doesn't light up as bright as a 100 watt light bulb. It's 24 watts, correct, 24 bulbs. But you know, any of the amperages, you know, you could have on 70 amps, 80 amps. It didn't matter on the variac. It's amazing. Anyway, back to your work.
A light bulb limits the color. Yeah, I agree. It's from the resistance of the filament. So the filament is going to limit the current. You can set the power supply to offer at 70 amps, but it's only going to have a small amount of current, and it's designed to optimize its 120 volts of electricity. So giving it to 24 is going to give you a dim light bulb. So I agree. I think that was that.
Yes, it's only about 24 volts there, but you have a direct short when you're welding, so you will light up the light bulb. Some of the more modern machines use pulse current. They have two SCRs back-to-back, and they have different ways of pulsing the conduction cycle over.
Okay, but that was just, again, because you're limiting it by the resistance, you probably even have a dimmer light bulb if it was pulsing.
WS1.
Yes, Paul?
Anyway, like the other fellow, I spent my decades doing welding. But, you know, I remember Dick used to talk about there's got to be 28 different types of ham radio. And it's the same holds true for welding. There's so many different types, depending on what you're welding and the equipment. And the MIG welders and the Heliarc. By the way, the Heliarc is one of the ones that we were talking about before. You can either run argon through it, or you can run carbon dioxide through it. I've done both. And they came up with the name Heliarc, you know, from the helium, but that's pretty much not used nowadays. Anyway, back to you.
Well, that is also spot welding.
Oh, yeah, spot welding, and now they're using friction stir welding to weld these big tanks together. Oh, there's no end.
Interesting. Talking about the spot welding, in Europe I had a few big humongous spot welding machines, actually. And here I have a miniature one. With different heads, and with the company, I have to look the brand, but it's pretty much non-American companies that make them. The reason that I bought it is that I'm using for film and photography, I'm using a lot of equipment that has a battery. And I noticed also that when I was having the portable tools like hammer drills, battery operators from Hilti, they changed the product and they no more produce the battery, but the cell by itself could be purchased from China. But then that cell has to be welded to another cell that then to another cell to give you the proper voltage and the current. And welding and soldering is impossible because they use stainless steel, a very thin one. So welding is the option. So I put actually spot welder exactly for that purpose. But I was surprised when the company charged me $179 just for pair of the welding electrodes. Those are just thick electrodes. So you put the battery and you put the metal on it and then you press and then you have it welded. So it's extremely expensive now, and to clear.
Okay, that's very interesting, Wesley. As you mentioned, spot welding, the only application I could see for it is every so often I will come across, as you do, batteries, the little coin batteries and such, where there's no mounting devices. They're spot welded to a strip of metal that then can be soldered into the power connection. So, yeah, the only thing I could think of using a spot welder personally for is, you know, fixing batteries that need to be spot welded together or spot welded for an electrode that pad that can be soldered.
Oh, yeah. Especially when you think about Hilti, let's say, the Hilti hammer drill, battery operated, 36 volts, they have 60 volts, and I think 80 volts too. The battery is like $300. And the hammer by itself, is over $1,000. And now the time passed by, they don't make it any longer. You have a machine almost not used, but the battery is not working good, and now you have to change the cells, because you cannot buy the battery. So that was actually me prolonging the life of my tools for quite a few years, but I didn't do it by welding. I was just going to the Chinese guys in Queens who were having a Chinese welder, and they were strip welding those thin pieces of metal connecting two cells together. And
okay, yeah, that's an option too if you know where to find these people. It probably is more cost effective to have someone else do it. Depends on how much your battery work you really do. I've had to throw out a couple of little things because I couldn't spot well the battery I wanted to. So it would be cost effective to buy a $100 chain spot welding.
Oh, yeah. It's not only for that. The lab equipment is going to have $100,000, actually $93,000, Vortex, Detective EX, which is the isotope identifier. So it gives you not only the energy of the specimen, but also the particular isotope that is in the specimen. Then it has a battery. But you cannot buy it. When you go to the manufacturer, they ask you, they tell you, we know that the battery dies, but you need to return the tool to us for $30,000. We're going to do the inspection and we'll give you the new battery. $3,000. The battery costs what? $3, $6, $10, whatever. You take $6 and you make it work again into next year.
Okay, very good. Yeah, well, there's a big markup for laboratory equipment. You know, business takes it off as a tax deduction. Research facilities probably do the same. You can't really do that, so yeah, that they got you coming and going. So it's very cost effective for you with your equipment. Again, I don't really have that type of equipment, so not terribly cost effective for me.
Yeah, but many people, they have drones. They have modern electronics, even flashlights, whatever. And everything has a different type of battery, but everything is the same cell. So they don't have to use huge, or I recall huge. That's the name of the company. It's a reputable company, absolutely reputable military contractor, and they do a lot of stuff. But you can buy a Chinese welder that is made specially for this purpose, and it's on eBay. What is it going to cost? $200? I don't remember the price. Some very expensive ones cost not more than $1,200. But then you have it for lifetime, and you can use it, and it's specially made for that. Enter it here.
Okay, I understand. Again, in my particular situation, I don't think that I would be able to rationalize the savings for such an investment. I think I've only thrown out one battery because I couldn't spot weld it. That probably set me back an entire $5. So, not much more to do. But anyway. I think it's coming up time to sum this all up, Wesley, is because Paul is late to do the space tech report.
Paul, I'm sorry. Usually it was me who says it's the time for Paul. Paul Picasso.
Let me be the one to do it. That's what I do here. I want to thank everyone for participating. Let me just see if I have a little repeater. Okay. It's nice that I have a repeater. Thanks to everyone who participated today. It's a little weird at the beginning. Guy wandered by, didn't quite know where he was, what he was doing. I don't know. Interesting, I'm sure. Anyway, thanks everyone. Please enjoy the SpaceNet report. I'll be back to tie it up in a bow a little bit later on. So now, with no further ado, is Paul WS2N with the SpaceNet report.
Very good. Thanks, Paul. That's WS2N. And a report for the TechNet. By the way, very good that you brought up the welding topic. I could talk about that all night, Wesley. So, a lot of things happening worldwide with the space program. But one thing I just want to lead off with was the HARP experiment that they did back in the end of December. HARP is the all those antennas and transmitters that are up in Alaska, north of the capital. I think it's about 300-400 miles away from that. Anyway, they have this whole area set up with HARP. It's called the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program, built in the 90s, and by DARPA, they got involved with it. They used all kinds of HF experiments. They send signals up, heat up the ionosphere and all. And when they were done with it, instead of letting it go to waste, they turned it over to the University of Alaska. So they're handling it now. And now they wanted to do an experiment they wanted to transmit all this power. It was 9.2. They wanted to transmit and hit a asteroid that was moving by, and they wanted to see by doing this the reflections that come back, and they'll be able to tell if it's a solid rock type of asteroid or if it's made of rubble. They are evaluating the results now. When they're doing it, they ask the amateur community worldwide to pay attention to this, because they were going to be transmitting on and off for around, I think they said 17 hours, which they did.
A question. I didn't quite understand. You're going to shoot at the asteroid?
N2RQ. He said he did it. But anyway, they were asking for reports from amateurs to see what they heard, and I think they were going to send out QSL cards or something to anybody that sent it in. I didn't do it. I was busy. It was holidays. I didn't do it. I hope they have another asteroid that comes by in the future where they can do it again. Anyway, back to you, Wes.
Okay, so they are shooting at the asteroid. The reflection is intended to be received by ham radio amateurs. Is the ham radio amateurs the purpose of the experiment, or they have something else in mind?
I don't know if they used anybody else. You know, I started reading this a month or so ago when they were going to do it. And it was ARR at email that they were sending out. So that's been eventually stored in QSC. Now they sent this, printed this up. It was basically thanking the ham radio community for doing what they were doing. I read 300 different reports were sent in. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that. I was thinking, if that would be, but it is not, because the antenna structure of the Aurora Altium HARP, I don't believe can create a narrow beam. But if we have a small body in the sky and we shoot at that body in the space, a humongous beam, what would be the radiation pressure and direction?
Dozens of massive antennas and transmitters out there. I'll have to review this YouTube. We have it on the Limar channel. There was a Limar invited a guy that knew all about HARP to do a presentation, and it's up now. It's actually on the Limar YouTube channel. You look for the HARP presentation. This guy was on and on. He's just terrific. What went on with that facility, how it was built, detail after detail. I'll have to review that. You can do that too, Wesley. Go to Limar homepage, go to the YouTube channel, and then search for the HARP video. Give you a lot of information. Anyway, back to you, Wes.
Thank you very much for that information. Now, I'm going to say something crazy. There was a small man-made apparatus that collided with the asteroid. And if you look at the mass of of that apparatus compared to the mass of the asteroid and the power of the collision. They did it for the purpose of measuring deflection of the humongous asteroid comparing to the man-made apparatus. So then, yes. But the crazy thing is, we were to shoot humongous amount of power at the same, or maybe smaller, asteroid. Could we see any deflection because of radiation pressure into X-ray?
Yeah, could we do something with the radiation threat? I'm at the very end.
KT2BHD, would a comment on this, this threat?
Go ahead.
Okay, let me see if I have it. Yeah, okay, I think Wesley's talking about the DOD program. BHD, was it? Go ahead.
I think Wesley's trying to say, is it possible that Pocono knows that a finely tuned instrument of the solar system possibly like to be taking the spokes of a bicycle wheel and do something we did not intend? I think that's what he's trying to say. And he makes a good point. I'll leave it up to you guys to take from there. Take it to PhD.
Well, if that's what Wesley's saying, then I agree. I agree. I don't believe in testing fate, and could be doing that. And I mean, they figured this all out, but you know, in the future, there's going to be more of this, I'm sure. And I don't know. I'm kind of skeptical. I always think somebody decades from now, some far country that learns this technology. And, you know, they all want to meet their maker and take everybody with them, you know. Figures out, oh, okay, this is how they did this, and, you know. Instead of taking an asteroid and making sure it doesn't come near Earth, you know, they, let's see if we can hit the Earth, you know. You never know. They're testing space. But, who knows? I've read things like that before, anyway, they're doing pretty good with this one. Anyway, the results were that they did change the orbit of the one that was going around it. There was two of them. One was going around the other, and it did change the time for one to revolve around the other one. And in doing that, it changed its 5-point low point, the apogee and perigee. And in doing that, it changed when the direction that the big one was actually moving. And that was actually the goal. They slowed the other one down by hitting it by a couple of degrees for a certain amount of time. And by doing that, they actually were able to move, actually both of them slightly off course. Proved out their theory. Any other comments? Anyway, NASA is very happy with the two of their space telescopes, TESS and James Webb. TESS has been up there, I think, since 2017. I believe it was launched by a Falcon 9 rocket. And it's in an extremely high orbit. It goes halfway to the moon, close to, maybe 150,000 miles out, and then it comes back to Earth and comes relatively close to Earth. And when it's away, it's doing all its experiment. I think it's got four telescopes on there and it's scanning the skies and looking for, looking at stars within 200 light years of Earth and looking at the light of the stars, and if the light dim a little bit, they know a planet moves in front of it. And if it repeats, you know, a week later or a month later, they know a planet is going around. Well, it hasn't found many, many planets so far. Locality of 200 light years away. And now I found another one that this time is very close, that's 90% the size of Earth. So they're very happy about that. I mean, it's very close to this star. It's still the capability of tests. It's really doing transiting exoplanet survey satellite. Along with this, last week, the James Webb Space Telescope and got results on it finding a planet, and this one, for some reason, they know it's 99% mass of Earth, the size of Earth, and again, very close to its parent star, and again, it goes around the star in a matter of days, very quick orbit, and it is tidally locked. In other words, one side is facing the star all the time, so it's not revolving. The chances of really having life there is probably nil, although on the twilight zone area, the area where it's always, you know, sun on one side and dark on the other, that halfway point, it is possible. Because it's in a Goldilocks zone where you could actually have liquid water. Where liquid water is and heat and chemicals, you know, theory is you can have light. But it's also, telescope also has a spectrometer on board, and it can tell the chemicals that are coming off of this planet. And they're going to eventually release the information on that in the future. So they've come a long way. I mean, you know, back in the 1980s, it wasn't up until I think mid-1990s when they were able to confirm an exoplanet going around. Well, the original one was around Pulsar, but now they've got literally 5,000 planets that are confirmed with all these different instruments they've used over the years. Kepler telescopes and now TESS and James Webb, and it's going to go on and on. I don't know how the scientists are keeping up with all the data and try to figure out which data to really pay attention to. I guess they're having a ball doing it. Anyway, that's one of the breakthroughs with James Webb Space Telescope, along with TESS. And more to follow as they look at the sky. James looks out at Lagrange Point 2 doing his work, and TESS is orbiting Earth, going all the way out halfway to the moon, and all the way back. Any comments before I go on? WS.
10-2-1-year, John.
Okay, I got N2YU, I think it was. Anyway, I heard John. Back to you. Same here, Paul. WS Blunt.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. This is November, Quebec, one uniform. So we know that James Webb is in infrared. There's beautiful pictures that come out that are produced. Is there a recognized algorithm or plan for taking an infrared image and converting it into visual light so we can see it on screen? What's the translation system? How does that work?
Yeah, well, the infrared pictures that are coming back, you know, are being converted so we can see these pictures. That's why we're getting these pictures. we agree on that, right, John?
Right, we do. Yeah, the question I have is that every time an infrared piece of information is captured, is it universally agreed that it's translated to a blue or a green or a red, or how does that work?
But, you know, they have the infrared, or in this case, it's near infrared band, and it goes from a certain amount of nanometers to whatever it might be, you know, 800 nanometers or something above. It might be the other way around. Anyway, it's got a certain band, and so I'm sure they're taking, you know, which frequencies are, you know, coming in. The higher frequencies are, you know, they're probably being converted to, red, and lower frequencies, maybe down to violet or something. They must convert it. I'm sure that, but, you know, I'm sure that's all being done with their computers from, they've been at this for years with a lot of infrared pictures, so I'm sure that the system is the same from one telescope to another, right? Back to you, John.
So does that mean that it's universally accepted that any time a certain frequency of infrared or near infrared anywhere is captured, it's universally, everybody knows that it's converted to a blue-green or a red or something like that? Is that a standard?
I would think so. You know, I really never gave much of a thought to it. You know, they've been at this for years with not only infrared, but, you know, ultraviolet, you know, things that you can't see. You know, they're able to convert this to actual pictures. So they must be taking that band and, you know, taking whatever frequency it is, that must, you know, correspond to a certain color. But it's amazing that, you know, I thought maybe Ben had asked me the question, why don't they have an actual, you know, picture of visible light, you know, what Hubble has, by the way. Hubble has a little bit of infrared as well. I thought you were going to go down that road, but you're not. In case anybody's wondering about that, the universe is stretching out, so when those light waves were sent out across the universe billions of years ago, they might have been light waves at one time, because the universe is stretched out, now it's converted to stretched out to infrared or near infrared by the time it gets to us. So, you know, I mean, at one time, you know, if you push these light rays that are hitting the telescope all the way back to where they started from, they would actually see those different colors back to each other.
Go ahead.
Okay, he said go ahead, Wesley. So back to you.
This is the code at CIR. I'm not sure he said what's going to apply to the first code, but how do you know about driving or components of the solar body or body in space, and if there were any organic or inorganic compounds there because of the light. So if we have visible light, then our eyes act as an antenna. A certain light, a certain electromagnetic wave has a certain feature, so infrared can shake the mirror, and ultraviolet can break the bond of the mirror. So if we have the source that is out there in space that has its own infrared radiation. All we need is just to look at the pattern of it, and we don't have to create anything. So that's what the telescope is for, whether the Hubble telescope or Webb telescope is for. But I'm not sure if they actually applied for it. Let me go.
Paul?
That's why I stand by the question.
Yeah, there's a couple of things. Most likely those electromagnetic waves started as much higher energy, gamma or ultraviolet, slowed down through infrared. ChatGPT has a good answer for how NASA comes up with the pseudo colors for infrared images, if you're interested.
Sounds good. I'm thinking about John's question. You think about it, radio waves too. You know, what they're doing. You scanning the skies with you know, and then next thing you know, you have a picture. You know, how do you get that? Well, that'd be the same type of system. Anyway, what does the chat say, Roy? Thank you.
Okay, this is AC2GS, by the way. This is ChatGPT. That's artificial intelligence. It says, NASA uses various algorithms and techniques to determine the pseudo color of infrared images. One common method is to assign different colors to different ranges of infrared wavelengths. For example, red might be used to represent the longest infrared wavelength, while blue might be used to represent the shortest infrared wavelength. This allows scientists to easily identify and distinguish different features in the image based on their infrared characteristics. Another method that NASA uses is to apply a false color to the image, which assigns colors to the different wavelengths in the images that are not necessarily representative of their true colors. This method is used to highlight specific features or to make it easier to see certain details in the image. Additionally, NASA uses radiometric scaling to adjust the brightness and contrast of the image to bring out details in the scene and make it easier to see the details.
Very good. Very good. I've been hearing about this on the news, this, what you're using there, the artificial intelligence they have. One guy said he wanted to write up a resume, and this thing wrote up, he told him a few things about himself, and this thing made up a whole resume for the guy. It sounds like the same thing that you're using. Very good, Roy. Go ahead.
Let's see, we have infrared. Infrared is between 1380 and 1310 nanometers. This sender is actually discovering both the organic and inorganic compounds. And they call it containing CD2O species. So they have a numbering in letters of the alphabet what species could be present in. But then they have another range, which is from E to F. And those have a strong characteristic IR band between 1465 and 1330 nanometers. And those give you a more accurate Raman spectroscopy information about the species that could be discovered in space. So that's the part of FTIR in space. What I believe is infrared and Raman bands are associated in looking at the space, deep space around us. But that, I'm not sure, because I wasn't studying the James Webb telescope and what it does, maybe you know.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I looked at a lot of the different things that they have, not in extreme detail. I was amazed how many times the light changes direction once it gets inside that telescope, you know, it's the 21-foot diameter mirror. It hits the secondary mirror, which doesn't move, by the way. Well, they could actually reshape it, but it doesn't really move on its axis. All the 18 mirrors do. Anyway, it goes above the second, and it hits the tertiary every one. And the third little mirror inside, and that, again, reflects it into boxes, and depending on which instruments they use. They get four different instruments on board. And one of the instruments is a near infrared one. But then from there, it's unbelievable. It changes direction. I don't know how many different times. You know, it goes to different locations. One of them goes off to a spectrometer, and it's amazing what this whole thing even works. You know, it's working very good. Fascinated by how many times this thing the light has changed directions by the time it actually gets to the charge couple device to convert that and eventually send it to a transmitter on 8 gigahertz to send back to the deep space network. It's quite a problem. They've been at this for a long time with different telescopes, but this one is, of course, the Casmiao. Any other comments?
ACTPL query.
ACTPL, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. I was just wondering, Wesley was talking about IR and Raman. I'm not exactly sure how you're differentiating between them.
Depends what application you're talking about. It starts from a very primitive fluid, catalytic cracking all materials and goes to space research. It could be in Raman, it could have a spectral interpretation for infrared, and then we could look for different kinds of species. So let's say on Earth we could deal with chlorine atoms and have a recognition of them, but also their phase and other properties. We could find out bromine atoms with that or many others. The only difference is that if we're looking at space and we have everything ready, we don't have to deliver anything. All we need is just to look at it and analyze due to similar structures with the infrared and Raman spectra structure correlations. I'm not sure if my English is clear enough to explain.
Perhaps not. They are the same frequency range. They're just looking at different vibrational modes. QSL?
That is correct. So let's say we have a scissor vibration, we have a wag vibration, we have a plane vibration, and that is actually assigned to the different wavelengths. So let's say 1265 would be Amit 3, right? The 1416 would be scissor vibration, and so on. So we look at the wavelength and the spectra, we actually could see plenty of what that spectra represents. Do you agree with that?
Obviously we're on the same wavelength, no pun intended. We're going to go back to NASA. I think we're off on a tangent.
Very good. Very good, guys. And, I know you can still hold that on this particular topic. No problem. Anyway, let me just go through a couple of other things. This Friday, anyway, they're going to have another spacewalk, another EVA. To increase the amount of power that the space station delivers right now. They were at 165 kilowatts. And eventually, when they finish installing these new solar panels, they call roll out solar arrays, actually, they call them IS IPOSIS or International Space Station rollout arrays anyway. Instead of big panels, roll out. They're actually more sensitive, so 30% more effective than the existing panels. By the time they're done, they've already done a couple of these. By the time they're done, they're going to be doing six instead of the eight. That, you know, if you look at the whole space station, it looks like eight big sets of panels. They're going to be doing six sets. That's all they need. They're trying to bring the kilowatt hours up to 215 instead of 165. Will be more than they need, and of course they're new, and it will sustain that power for a long period of time. All the time they do degrade, but the original panels went up, they're closer to 200,000, and now they're down to, closer to 200 kilowatts, and now they're down to around 165. The spacewalk is one of many. Each time they get a new set of solar arrays up, it takes around 2 or 3 spacewalks to complete. You know, set it all up, and eventually they bring their rolls out and connect them and stretch them out. But anyway, you got Nicole Mann. She'll be out there. She was a commander for a flight that went up on Dragon, SpaceX. And then you're going to have the Japanese astronaut with her. By the way, they're both hams, so that's the four hams doing a spacewalk Friday. And let me just move on to a couple of other topics before I run out of time. This is WFMY. I'll go through this quickly. We had about 5% failures worldwide. One was China. China lost contact with the Mars rover, and it also was losing contact with the Mars orbiter. The Mars rover and orbiter were sent up at the same time, in one mission a few years ago, and went into orbit, stayed in orbit for about 4 or 5 months. Looking for a landing zone. They decided on one, and they separated the rover from the orbiter, and it's been successful. It landed on the planet Mars, and solar panels, and it's been riding around ever since, until now. I believe the solar panels have collected enough Martian dust to affect the mission. Looks like that thing is finished. Now they say they are also having trouble making contact with the orbiter. They decided to change its orbit for some reason, and doing that, something might have gone wrong. They lost the capability of talking to its orbiter. And that was one screw up. Then you have another one.
Mobile amateur radio club repeater system. Code number 9126 on the New England
orbital. Link clear. Virgin Orbital is a offspring of Virgin Galactic. Virgin Galactic, you might remember, a couple of years ago, they developed a spaceship
that time takes
people to the edge of space, not to orbit, but to the edge of space. Eventually, they wanted to charge people hundreds of thousands of dollars each for a ticket. Richard Branson eventually got to go on that flight, which I'm sure he's very happy to have seen. He went to the edge of space, but then they decided to rebuild this whole thing, this whole spacecraft, upgraded. It hasn't gone to orbit all over a year now, a year and a half. They're working on it. They think eventually they're going to be doing it in the future. But they're having
welcome to the
Lone
Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system.
The spin-off system was called
New England
Virgin Orbit.
Link active.
The manned flights, Virgin Galactic. Unmanned flights are Virgin Orbital. And that's the one that just dropped from a 747. And the you know, 45,000 feet. And then it's called Mantra 1, goes into space. It had two successful missions so far from the United States. They wanted to do this from England, so. Branson is from England, so they decided to do this, and it took off from England, from an English